freedom is precisely what must be destroyed if this is to be turned into a fundamentally different country to suit Obama's vision of the country and of himself.
Look, folks, there comes a time when it's time to stop fiddling while America burns.
That's right. Woo!
If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
And every time they mess with it, they make it worse.
What they are trying to do is create an America very unlike the America that has existed for centuries.
And regardless of their sincerity, their humanitarian motives, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
This is KLZ Freedom 560 with your host, Ken Clark.
Welcome back. Hour 2, Freedom 560 on this Tuesday afternoon. I guess it's trying to decide whether or not it wants to rain or not. I've got to make a correction. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that Lana Four is going to be speaking. She's not going to be speaking at the Littleton Tea Party. She's going to be speaking at the Lakewood Tea Party. Now, I saw a post that she had made earlier in the day. She is going to be announcing her run for president. Let's hear it for Lana. She's, what, number 56 in the mix. I was at least in the top 30 when I announced my run for president. So Lana's really, really late to the game. And so who knows what's going to be happening. I'm kidding, of course. Neither one of us are running for president. But, you know, she's going to be speaking at the Lakewood Tea Party today at 7. It is at 1490 South Pierce Street. Thank you for giving me that update and making that correction for me. Linda, I really appreciate it. And you know, there's a lot going on today, so it's kind of tough to keep up. As promised, I do want to talk about it because I want to talk about the Magna Carta. We've got an anniversary for the Magna Carta. Things 800 years old. 800 years old. That is amazing. So who better than to talk about it? Professor Robert Nadelson, senior fellow at the Independence Institute, constitutional scholar, and author of the book, The Original Constitution. Professor, welcome back to Freedom 560.
Good to be back. Clark for president.
Yeah, my campaign slogan is, I promise you this, that, and the other thing.
So how are you different from anyone else?
I just want the money. At least I'm straight up and honest. I figure if I set up the Clark Foundation, with all the influence I can peddle, if I am elected to the presidency, I should be worth a good $2.3 billion, right?
Oh, wait. I repeat, then how are you different from anyone else?
Well, I'm not. That's the whole point, except right. I'm at least honest about it, Professor, and I tell people up front, I want your money.
Well, I'll support you under those circumstances because you're the only candidate I actually know personally.
There you go. And yeah, I would not make a good president or politician for that matter, because I do have a tendency to speak the truth. Maybe that would be refreshing. I don't know. It'll be interesting. So you just got back from a trip overseas. Tell us about that. Had to do with the Magna Carta, yes?
Yeah. I was in England for several days, and the top priority in England, and as you know, I spent some time there. I lived there for a while when studying constitutional sources in Oxford. But the primary reason for going this time was to visit the British Library. The British Library, primary national library of the UK, had an exhibition going on commemorating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, and it was something that I really needed to see, and I'm glad I went. I should also mention to you, Ken, that this is not a new interest of mine. I've been into the subject for many years, although my primary beat is the U.S. Constitution. When the editors of the Encyclopedia of the Supreme Court of the United States wanted someone to write the entry on Magna Carta, I was the one they turned to. And so I've written on the subject as well.
So tell me about it. First, I think it's important. Let's give a little bit of history on the Magna Carta itself, because a lot of people have heard about it, but I don't know that a lot of people understand the significance of it. So let's start there.
Well, it's an enormously significant document. It actually, the initial version of it was signed in 1215. The word Magna Carta literally means big parchment. And it was called the Magna Carta, or Big Charter, to distinguish it from the Charter of the Forest, which was issued at the same time as a later version of Magna Carta. It wasn't called Magna Carta originally. Originally, it was called the Charter of Runnymede or the Charter of Liberties of England. Now, there were many medieval charters issued by kings in order to reassure barons and others who might be dissatisfied with their rules. What makes the Magna Carta unique is not merely that it is a medieval charter, but that it has a breadth and a universality that no other medieval charter has. And it became the basis of the freedom of Englishmen and of people in the English-speaking people, the English-speaking people throughout the world, including the United States. It was used over the years to resist royal tyranny. It was used by our founders to resist the British during the pre-revolutionary era, and then it was incorporated effectively in our system. If you read Magna Carta carefully, you'll see many echoes of it in various parts of the U.S. Constitution. So it is, I think, by any measure, the most influential constitutional document in history, at least in Anglo-American history.
So you would put that, and I guess one of the reasons that you would make a statement like you just did is because our Constitution did use a lot of the underlying premises that were in the Magna Carta, use that as, you could almost say, as part of the foundation.
That's right. The Constitution is a very large and important branch of the Anglo-American constitutional tradition, but the Magna Carta is really the root or the trunk. That is really where a lot of it comes from. Now, there were earlier charters, for example, when the barons got up and decided that they were going to resist King John, who was the unscrupulous king on the throne at the time they demanded Magna Carta, they looked back to some of the earlier charters for inspiration. But Magna Carta went far, far beyond that.
Okay, so when you say that it went far, far beyond that, what exactly does that mean?
Well, the most important way in which Magna Carta differs from every other medieval charter is in its universality. Let's back up just a bit. John, the king at the time, was described by one of the advisors of the British Library Project as a nasty piece of work. And I think that's true. I mean, if you remember your Robin Hood legend, good King Richard was away, and evil Prince John, his younger brother, was in charge and made things very oppressive. Well, when King Richard died in 1199, and John took the throne, because Richard didn't have any children, when John took the throne, he didn't improve any. He was not a stupid man. He was an intelligent man, and he was could be a very, very charming man. But he was utterly ruthless and utterly unreliable. I mean, you think about some of the leaders we've had in our country who, real charming, but, you know, their word is worthless. Well, that was John. And ultimately, he wound up offending large parts of the country. Now, at that time, Britain was ruled by a Norman French nobility. These were people whose ancestors come from France. They spoke French in daily life. They were very much separated from the bulk of the English population, which spoke an early version of English and was generally hostile to the Norman nobility. But John proved to be such a horrible king that that everybody joined up against him, Norman and Saxon alike. And formed this very broad coalition. And one of the effects of that, and the effects of some other factors as well, is that Magna Carta in its final edition didn't just defend the barons. I mean, the barons extracted it, but it included important protections for all kinds of people who were not part of the nobility or who were not politically powerful, women, merchants, city dwellers and city governments, in some cases all freemen, about half the population benefited from Magna Carta, and in a few instances even the unfree serfs, again about half the population, benefited from Magna Carta. So there was a sweep to this document, a universality to this document that was unprecedented and in fact didn't recur until centuries later.
You know, I find that interesting because we still are in a situation, and we can talk about that when we come back, because I have made the comment over and over again that there are basically two classes of three of people with a subset in one of the classes. And the Magna Carta was written to try to combat this. And I'm going to throw this out there, Professor, and then we can respond to it on the other side of the break. Sure. You've got the ruling class, which is the Obamas, the Boehners, the Mitch McConnells, the Nancy Pelosi's, the Harry Reid, pretty much everybody inside the Beltway. Then you've got the rest of us. And the rest of us are divided into the dependent class, those that depend on government for their living. And then you've got the indentured servitude class, which are everybody that pays taxes and that therefore made indentured servitude, okay, both of which are slaves to the state to promote their agenda to the working class. We'll have more with Professor Nadelson right after this. Welcome back. Freedom 560. I'm your host, Ken Clark. I have on the line with me the one and only Professor Robert Nadelson, senior fellow with the Independence Institute, author of the original Constitution. His work has been in front of the United States Supreme Court countless times. I'm sure they're a big fan. Welcome back, Professor.
Good to be back.
So, but when we left the end of the last break, and this is nothing new under the sun. I mean, this is, goes back 6,000 years. We've seen the same thing happen. You have the ruling class controlling everybody else. And right now, everybody else consists of the dependent class and the indentured servitude class, which are both slaves to the ruling class. What say you, sir?
Well, you asked me specifically to try to make a connection there with Magna Carta and whether that was true then. I mentioned that Magna Carta is unique in many ways, in some ways, and one is its universality. If you look at some of the other charters that were issued by kings during the medieval era, you know, they're there for the benefit of the barons, and that's it. Now, when you look at Magna Carta, you see that it actually went well beyond the ruling class. Now, I don't want to push this too far. I mean, Magna Carta is not some grand statement of the universal rights of man. It wasn't designed to be that. A lot of it deals with problems in the feudal system. A lot of it is for the benefit of the barons. But on the other hand, you see things like the following. This is chapter 39 of the charter. The charter is divided into little sections called chapters. And it reads, "No free person shall be taken or imprisoned or dispossessed or outlawed or exiled or in any way destroyed, nor will we, the king, go against him, except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land." Now, that is the basis of the due process rule. It's the due process of law rule that appears in English law and in American law, and in our U.S. Constitution. But notice that it is not just given to the barons. It's not just given to a few people. It's given to all free persons, which was about half the population of England. That's an extraordinary provision. Often, by the way, let me just mention this quickly. Sometimes you'll see that translated as "no free man shall be taken or imprisoned." But the Latin word used here actually means a person. So women could and did claim the protection of this particular provision. From now on, you couldn't be convicted of anything except by a judgment of your peers or the law of the land. The law of the land basically means due process.
So they do make a distinction between the free persons, and the Constitution was all men are created equal. And, you know, that, and again, I'll go back to it. I know we did have slavery then, but it was because of the Constitution and the way it was written that we were able to end slavery. It set the stage to end that abomination of our history.
Yeah, traditionally the term man, all men are created equal, meant human beings generally, or it could mean just male human beings. Today, under the last generation of political correctness, we sometimes have to remind folks that the term man is used in a generic sense. And so when we talk about this important protection and other protections in Magna Carta, it's really important to remember that the term, or the Latin word, actually means person. So it's very definitely generic. There also were in Magna Carta some very specific provisions for women. Let me give you an example. When a lord or any landowner died, King John would sometimes say to the widow, "Okay, lady, I want you to marry, you know, Bill Smith, because I like Bill Smith and I want to give him the control of your fortune." And the woman could say, "Well, your majesty, I don't like Bill Smith. I don't want to marry Bill Smith." And the king would say, "Sorry, dame, I'm your overlord. You have to obey me." And so the woman very often would have to pay substantial amounts of money in order to get an exemption. This is how King John, one of the ways in which King John raised money. Well, Magna Carta said, no more. No woman anymore is compelled to marry someone that she doesn't want to marry. So there were several provisions that protected women, and there were also provisions that protected all free men, and even a few that protected serfs, which is just amazing.
Wow, that's good stuff.
One other point, too. I want to mention this because I want to make sure it comes up. There is one part of Magna Carta, and this answers your question about ruling class versus lower class directly. It's chapter 60 of Magna Carta, and in it, it says that we, the barons, who are being given these grants, these liberties, these privileges by King John, just as we get them from John, we hereby promise to extend them to our own vassals. How about that?
That is pretty impressive. That's good stuff. I mean, that did set the stage for women's rights, and I mean, that it goes back 800 years. That's good.
It's called equal protection.
Yeah,
that latter thing is equal protection. The big debate over Magna Carta has always been in two ways. One, you've got those people who want to claim that this is really some charter of, you know, modern type charter of human rights, and that seems to me to be wrong. And then you have people on the other side, and I think some of them were informing the way that the British Library set up their exhibit, who seem to think that Magna Carta actually was just a feudal document and only became important in later years. I think the truth is somewhere in between those. But if you acknowledge that Magna Carta has all these, you know, these broad provisions, one of the most debated questions is why? Why was it that this charter, 1215 AD, was, you know, went so far beyond the others? What was it about this process? And that's a matter that's still under debate. We could talk about it if you like.
Yeah, I would like to talk about that. We don't have a whole heck of a lot of time in this segment to do that, but it kind of reminds me of, and I'm going to just throw this out there, the reason that it went so far is because they had tyrannical government. They had a tyrannical royal that was running roughshod over everyone, and you take a look at today's government, and it's kind of a similar situation. We've got a lawless president who doesn't respect the Constitution, and you know, drastic times call for drastic measures, Professor.
Well, you know, that's you and I have talked about the right that the states have under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution to amend the Constitution. You and I have also mentioned that the founders put that in the Constitution for the purpose of dealing with the potential of an overreaching or abusive federal government. This was foreshadowed once again by Magna Carta. There is a provision in Magna Carta called the Security Clause, which enables the barons, they set up a committee of 25 barons, to respond to abuses by the king. And just like it works in the Constitution, it's a multiple-stage process. You make a complaint to a committee of four barons, subcommittee of four barons. They then bring it to the big committee. The big committee gives the king a certain period of time to correct it. And if the king doesn't correct it, they've got the power actually to enforce it against him militarily. So I can't say that the constitutional provision in Article 5 came directly from Magna Carta. I don't think it did. But at the time of the Constitutional Convention, the people writing our Constitution, some of them were thinking in terms of, gee, we could use the states to check the power of the federal government, just like the barons and the baronies in England check the power of the crown. And so I don't think that the coincidence between the security clause in Magna Carta and Article 5 of the Constitution. I don't think that's entirely by accident.
Wow, that's interesting, because I didn't realize that there was a connection between the Magna Carta and Article 5. That's very interesting.
Because there's connection between Magna Carta and clause after clause of the Constitution. I mean, Magna Carta, for example, talks about the right of merchants to travel, and anybody else to travel in and out of the kingdom in times of peace. That right to travel was incorporated in the Articles of Confederation.
Professor, that music means we're up against a hard break. We'll continue that right after this. And I am back. This is Freedom 560. I'm your host, Ken Clark. On the air with me right now, I have Professor Rob Nadelson, Senior Fellow at the Independence Institute, constitutional scholar, author of The Original Constitution. Before we go on any further, Professor, where can people find your book, The Original Constitution and the writings that
you
have done?
I'm glad you clarified it was a book. I'm not actually the author of The Original Constitution.
It's a book about The Original Constitution.
Right. It's called The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. You can pick that up at Amazon. Also, I want to mention that we're having a presentation on Magna Carta tomorrow evening. So for those folks who are interested in learning about the what I've called the greatest constitutional document ever, can come. It's open to the public. It's at the Independence Institute, and it's at 5:30 in the evening. And you can register or learn more about it at i2i.org.
All right, very good. So when we left the last segment, you were talking about a chapter in Magna Carta, which was the Protections Clause. Did I remember that correctly?
The Security Clause.
The Security Clause, yeah. And that basically gave the barons the right to have redress against the royalty, just the same way the states now have the right of redress against the federal government in the form of Article 5. So that's a very unique correlation between the two documents. I think it's very powerful.
It is. It's very interesting. It also illustrates a very important aspect of Magna Carta, and that it is it's a document that was designed to subject the king to the rule of law. There were a lot of things that John was doing, taxing people without the consent of the realm, granting all kinds of exemptions that were not justified by the law. Boy, does that sound unusual, huh? He was doing things like that, and Magna Carta was designed to rein him in. Now, let me just make this clear. After John signed it on June 15th, 1215, he had no intention of being bound by it, and in a few weeks he actually repudiated it. So Magna Carta remained law in its original form for only a short period of time. However, the following year, John died. And in order to shore up support for his young son, who was only 9 years old, the new king, the officials around him, including the great Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton, issued Magna Carta again. There were some changes, but they issued it and said, look, you stick with the regime here, we will continue to recognize Magna Carta. So they issued it in 1216. They issued it again in 1217. They issued it again in 1225. And over subsequent years, whenever there was a problem between king and the public, it seemed that the king would come out and reaffirm Magna Carta. And then it was used by people who were freedom fighters, who were resisting royal authority throughout English history, notably in the 17th century. And so when the American colonists started to assert their rights against arbitrary government, what document do they think you think they turned to? Magna Carta. And so it was mentioned in the time leading up to the revolution, and then after the revolution, it continued to be a function or a feature of American law. And many of the state constitutional provisions and the U.S. constitutional provisions are based directly or indirectly on it. And right down to the current day, Magna Carta is repeatedly cited by the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's interesting. That's interesting. We talk an awful lot about how we don't like to use foreign documents as far as our Supreme Courts and all that. But when it comes to the Magna Carta, why would that be something that the Supreme Court would refer to as opposed to our Constitution, when a lot of people like me get upset when foreign law is introduced into domestic courts?
Okay. If you talk to people who oppose, who really thought about this, who oppose the introduction of foreign law, they will tell you that the basis, the common law basis, the basis of English law on which our system is erected, that's not what they mean by common law. So everything up until independence, and sometimes after independence, the Constitution, for example, has to be understood. It was understood as a document designed for a common law system. The common law was based in part on Magna Carta. For example, when the Constitution grants that no person actually recognizes that no person should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, that term due process of law comes from an early English interpretation of the law of the land clause that I quoted earlier from Magna Carta. And so that helps to explain what that constitutional clause means. Similarly, in Magna Carta, you've got protections against takings. That is to say, you've got clauses which say that the king can't take stuff from you without compensation. Obviously, that's an important backdrop to the Fifth Amendment protection against takings. And so in instance after instance here, you see that our law rests firmly on this English basis. You know, one of the quarrels I have with the multicultural crowd is a multicultural crowd is always trying to denigrate the Western tradition or denigrate the English tradition and raise up other traditions as equally important or equally valid. I'm not of English ancestry, but I will tell you that that's simply not true. That the English tradition in particular, the British tradition generally, including Magna Carta, are central. They are unique to the American political system in a way that, let's say, the system of Kenya is not.
That's interesting. That makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like when you go to the Articles of Confederation, you know, that was a good benchmark for what we used going into 1787 when we were writing the Constitution.
Yes.
But the Articles of Confederation were way too limited, way too strict. Some of us, including me, think it was a really good idea to have those kind of restraints on the federal government because they've blown through them so much. But at the same time, there was no way to amend or fix in the Articles of Confederation.
And so, our legal system, and we basically have a English common law legal system. In fact, if you look at the constitutions of most states, including Colorado, there'll be a provision in there that will say, unless otherwise reversed, the common law of England is the rule of decision in this state. You'll actually find that in state constitutions. The common law of England is the rule of decision in this state. And so obviously, citing the common law of England on a issue of federal importance is not the same as citing, let's say, the law of Afghanistan or France. I mean, it's a very different sort of thing.
That's interesting. So, you know, I like the idea that there is a place for the Supreme Court to go. Now, Professor, I just got to ask this question because you have taught constitutional law. You've studied constitutional law. You are a professor of law, constitutional law. So why then, when the Supreme Court has the Magna Carta, they have the Constitution, they have all this documentation, and I just have to ask this, and I know I'm doing it tongue in cheek, how come they get it wrong so often?
Oh, any number of reasons. I mean, let me give you a good example. A few years ago, they decided a habeas corpus case, the Beaumedienne case. And I think they reached the right result, but they reached it for the wrong reason. And the wrong reason because they were actually looking at English cases in order to understand the writ of habeas corpus. And the writ of habeas corpus comes from England. It was created in England. And when they read the English cases, I think they just misread them. I think that they just did not carefully read them enough. And so sometimes it's just a mistake. I mean, remember, judges are not trained historians. they rely upon law professors to write the articles. And unfortunately, law professors are very often not trained historians either, and they tend to try to make their own political opinions law. But it's really the historians and the scholars are supposed to be relying upon for that. And then, of course, judges are human, and not only do they make mistakes, but sometimes they engage in overreaching. And sometimes the issue is really difficult. I mean, most cases don't get to the U.S. Supreme Court unless they're very, very difficult cases. The other courts have split on them. The court may disagree on them. And so there are any number of reasons why they make those mistakes.
Well, yeah, and it seems to me that, like what we've seen recently, they make not just mistakes, but a lot of times they're promoting an agenda, and that's why we can't have activist judges on the bench. We can't have people that don't understand the fundamental premise behind the Constitution, why it was written the way it was originally, its intent, not as interpreted by the Supreme Court, because I think that's you that has said that there are two different constitutions, one that was originally intended and one that as interpreted by the Supreme Court. Is that right?
Well, I think that's right. A great example would be the notorious decision of Roe versus Wade, or Dred Scott versus Sanford. Roe versus Wade upended the abortion laws of all 50 states and federalized what was supposed to be a state issue. And Dred Scott versus Sanford held that African Americans could never be American citizens. This is a 1857 case that helped bring on the Civil War. Both of those cases were based upon supposedly interpretations of the part of the Constitution that says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. If you seriously examined what that phrase meant, including going back to Magna Carta and looking what its predecessors meant, there's no way you could conclude the way the court did in those cases. So understanding documents like Magna Carta is really important to interpreting modern law and getting the decisions right.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I we've got some real good justices on there, Clarence Thomas to name one. But I think that they do, unfortunately, go outside their bounds. Yet, the voice you're hearing is Professor Rob Nadelson, senior fellow with the Independence Institute, author of the book The Original Constitution. We're going to have more with him. We're talking about the Magna Carta right after this. Welcome back. This is Freedom 560. I'm your host, Ken Clark. I have on the line with me Professor Robert Nadelson. He is a senior fellow at the Independence Institute, constitutional scholar, and author of the book called The Original Constitution, What It Meant. Professor, what is the final part of that?
What it actually said and meant.
What it actually said and meant. Tell my listeners where they can go find that again.
Oh, it's on Amazon. Also, if you come to the Magna Carta, event tomorrow at the Independence Institute, there'll be copies of it on sale, and I'll sign it for you if you buy one. The event on Magna Carta is at 5:30 at the Independence Institute. That's 727 East 16th Avenue, open to the public. Check out more at i2i.org. That's the letter I, the number 2, the letter I, .org.
All right, very good. So we've been talking about the significance of the Magna Carta, and we've talked a lot about what kind of the situation we're in right now, where an Article 5 movement is afoot out there nationwide, and what that's designed to do. And I want to specifically talk about that and some of the other specific correlations between the Magna Carta and the Constitution, because that Article 5 movement is very powerful. It is a means for the states to look at the federal government and the $18 trillion in debt. Oh, and by the way, the debt has been frozen for the past 90 days, in case you're wondering whether or not you're getting the truth from the federal government. Yeah, you're not. But it is a way for us to go to them and say, you know what? You don't have the power of the purse anymore. You don't have the power of the checkbook anymore. If you want to spend money, you have to come to the states and ask our permission. Professor?
Well, as I mentioned, there's a parallel between that part of the Constitution and the so-called security clause of Magna Carta. And I don't think it's an accidental parallel, because when the founders were setting up the Constitution, they talked about using the, leaving the states, because there were a few people who just wanted to abolish the states, but leaving the states with semi-sovereign powers, almost like the barons in England, the nobility in England governed semi-sovereign fiefs, and leaving them there as a counterweight to the central government, so that just as the barons had had risen up against the crown in the rebellion leading to Magna Carta, so also, if necessary, the states could rise up against the federal government using Article 5 of the Constitution. That's one example of a parallel. You know, another one that we've not gotten into, but it's enormously important, is the part of Magna Carta which limits the power of the king. It says that basically the king cannot impose certain kinds of feudal financial exactions, certain kinds of taxes, if you will, without the common council of our kingdom. What that meant was, if the king wanted to raise taxes, he had to get the consent of a council, which originally were the barons, but eventually became parliament, and in this country became Congress. So the idea that Congress has the power of the purse, that the executive does not, that also is reflected in Magna Carta. Again, example after example after example.
Well, and we've got a situation now where the president just does whatever he wants. And because, and I know that, wow, this is really going to make you mad, but because he is also a constitutional scholar, he knows what he can and can't do when he breaks out his pen and his phone, right?
I mean, well, this, with respect, he's not a constitutional scholar.
I know.
I mean, you know, it became common to call him a constitutional law professor. What he was a local lawyer who was brought in by the University of Chicago Law School to teach one course. And there were actually two courses. One was involved race and the law, and the other was Constitutional Law 3. But Constitutional Law 3 was a very narrow course that basically dealt with issues of race and gender and that sort of thing. He never wrote on constitutional law. He was never on a, you know, on a faculty to teach constitutional law. He didn't get tenure. He was what we call an adjunct teacher, a community guy who comes in to teach a single course for a few thousand dollars.
Well, yeah, and I'm not real sure he can even spell Constitution. I mean, without a teleprompter, I don't think he could even pronounce the word.
Ken, he said right out in one of his books that there's no way of knowing what the original meaning of the Constitution is, and therefore, you know, the implication is why even bother to try? He never, you know, taught a true constitutional law course, so, you know, how would he know?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, but I mean, he has completely corrupted it, and it's time and time again. And what I also find interesting, and I want to ask this question, in Magna Carta, what were the separation of powers? Were there separation of powers in the Magna Carta?
Yeah, there were. You begin to see that it's not a complete system like in later, what you should see in later England or in the United States, but it's the beginning of it. One is the passage I just mentioned. The king is not, in Magna Carta is deprived of the right to simply uniformly or unilaterally impose certain taxes and charges. He's got to now go to a council in order to get permission. So you see the division here, beginning of the division between the executive and the legislative branch. There was a move by the barons to prevent the king from sending them abroad to fight wars, specifically in France, without their consent. That part was dropped, and this then reinforces the idea that the executive is the commander in chief of the military forces. So they, you know, they didn't interfere in that area. Also, there are a number of different provisions that dealt with the justice system. King John had corrupted the justice system in various ways. He had charged people. You know, the more you pay, the more likely a good verdict you're going to get. And several different provisions deal with that. They require a speedy trial. They require justice be free, that you not have to pay for it. And so you see the beginning of the division of the judicial power from the executive power. I don't want to overstate this, okay? This is really our system in its infancy and has a lot to grow yet. But it is definitely, as I mentioned, kind of the root or at the root of the constitutional tree that eventually grew up.
Well, and I find it interesting because that's where the beginnings were. And then when we had the Constitution in the United States, we had a very distinct separation of powers. And that is all, those lines have been so blurred now. They've transferred all the power to the executive branch. And Congress has basically given it over. And the judicial branch has decided that they can actually enact law themselves by the way they rule. And we've seen that over and over again. But Terrence asked me an interesting question that I thought I'd bounce off you during the break. We have the Magna Carta and then we had the Constitution. When were those documents ever followed to the letter of the law? My response to him was the reason that they become corrupted is because those that choose not to follow it reinterpret some of the clauses, reinterpret the words themselves.
It was a long struggle to ensure that Magna Carta was followed in England. But eventually the English prevailed, and there are parts of Magna Carta that are actually still on the statute books in England today. In this country, Magna Carta was followed. For example, you ever wondered where the idea came from that a court could refuse to follow a law that's unconstitutional, could strike it down as void? During the colonial era, Magna Carta was recognized as the supreme law of the colonies. And so if the colonial assembly passed a law that violated Magna Carta, it gets struck down.
So is that the original, where the original idea of nullification came from then?
No, it's one of the sources of the idea of judicial review, that the court, if the court faces, has a statute before it and has a constitution before it, and they contradict, then the court has to follow the statute. Has to follow the Constitution rather than the statute. Now, Magna Carta is not the only source of that, but that it's one of the sources of that.
It would be nice if we got back to that. So, Professor Robert Nadelson, you're talking about the history of the Magna Carta. It's what, 800 years old now?
800 years old. It was actually sealed by King John. He didn't sign it. He sealed it on June 15, 1215. And if you adjust for the calendar, because there's been a change in the calendar, the actual 800th anniversary is later this month on June 25.
Wow, that's going to be interesting. And so you're having an event talking about it, and that's going to be tomorrow night, right?
Tomorrow night, 5:30 at the Independence Institute, 727 East 16th Avenue. That's Avenue, not Street. And check it out at i2i.org.
All right. And then please tell my listeners one more time where they can get your book that you had written about the original Constitution.
You can pick it up at Amazon or you can come tomorrow and to the Magna Carta event and buy it there. And it also includes, it's on the original Constitution, and therefore it also includes information on Magna Carta.
Well, there you go. I appreciate that very much. Professor, thank you for joining me again today. I really enjoy these segments. And so thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Very good. So there you have it, my friends. That is one of the basis, one of the reasons why we had the Constitution written the way it was because of an 800-year-old document, the Magna Carta. I wanted to remind everybody that Lana Four is going to be announcing her run for president tonight at the Lakewood Tea Party, not in Littleton, the Lakewood Tea Party. She's going to be the speaker. Also, don't forget Liberty Libations tonight, which will be down in the Tech Center. Steve House has assured everyone that he will be there. I am definitely going to be going. And so that ought to be entertaining as well. And then on Friday, I'm going to be speaking to the Colorado Republican Business Coalition. That'll be from 11:30 to 1:30. I'm going to be talking about Initiative 20. Don't want to miss that. It'll be at the Pepsi Center downtown. And so there you have it. Lots going on. I'm sure we're going to have an awful lot of updates later in the day. Make sure you check your Twitter feeds to see what the latest breaking news is.